a soft, dim gloaming. Was it dawn? He was in a hypnagogic state. He felt as if his neural pathways were blocked. No pattern at all. Bonita, the police. The panic set in even before he could focus on the reasons. What time is it?
6 o'clock.
He looked at his legs again, at his shoes. Must be 6 o'clock at night. Came home at 5:30, fell asleep, still stretched out, in front of Bonita. A sense of propriety, as much as anything else, made him swing his legs off the bed and sit on the edge.
"What'd I tell him, Mr. McCoy?"
She must mean the doorman. He couldn't get it straight. They were downstairs, two policemen. He was sitting on the edge of his bed, trying to come to. There were two policemen downstairs with the doorman. What should he say? Tell him, "They'll have to wait a minute, Bonita." He stood up and started walking toward the bathroom, so groggy, so stiff. His head hurt. There was a rushing sound in his ears. The face in the bathroom mirror had the noble chin, but was creased and bleary and decrepit. His shirt was wrinkled and pulled out of his pants. He splashed water on his face. A drop of it hung from the tip of his nose. He dried his face with a hand towel. If only he could think. But it was all blocked. It was all fog. If he refused to see them, and they knew he was up here, and they did, then they'd be suspicious, wouldn't they? But if he talked to them and they asked him, what? He tried to imagine. He couldn't focus on it. Whatever they ask, he doesn't know. No, he can't take a chance, mustn't see them. But what had he told Bonita? They'll have to wait. As if to say, I will see them, but they'll have to wait a minute. Bonita! He went back into the bedroom, but she wasn't there. He went out into the hallway. Bonita!
Down here, Mr. McCoy!
From the hallway balcony, he could see her standing at the foot of the staircase. You haven't called down to the doorman yet, have you?
Yes, I call. I tell him they have to wait.
Shit. Implied he would see them. Too late to back out. Freddy. He'd call Freddy. He went back to the bedroom, to the telephone by the bed. He called Freddy's office. No answer. He called the main number of Dunning Spunget and asked for him. After what seemed like an interminable wait, was told he had gone. Call him at home. What was the number? In the address book downstairs in the library. He went running down the staircase. Realized Bonita was still in the entry gallery. Mustn't look rattled in front of her. Two policemen downstairs with the doorman, walked across the marble floor with what perhaps passed for a calm gait. He kept the address book on a shelf behind the desk. His fingers were shaking as he went through the pages. B. The telephone. It wasn't on the desk. Someone had left it on the side table next to the wing chair. An outrage. He hurried around the desk to the chair, time rolling by. He dialed Freddy's number. A maid answered. Buttons out to dinner. Shit. What now? Time rolling, rolling, rolling. What would the lion do? The sort of family in which cooperation with the authorities was automatic. There could be only one reason not to cooperate. You did have something to hide. Naturally, they would detect that immediately because you do not cooperate. If only... He left the library and went back out into the entry gallery. Bonita was still standing there. She looked at him very intently, and that was what did it. Didn't want to look frightened or indecisive in front of the servants. Didn't want to look like someone in trouble. All right, Bonita. He tried to sound like someone who was already bored and knew he was in for a further waste of time. What doorman's on tonight? Eddie?
Eddie.
Tell him to send them on up. Have them wait here. I'll be back down in a minute. He walked very deliberately up the staircase. When he reached the upstairs hallway, he hurried to the bedroom. What he saw in the mirror was someone very bleary and rumpled. He thrust his chin upward. That helped. He would be strong. He wouldn't lose his head. He would be... He allowed himself the phrase.
a master of the universe. How should he look? Should he put his jacket and tie back on? He had on a white shirt, the pants of a gray nail-head worsted suit, and a pair of black cap-toed shoes. With the tie and the jacket on, he would look terribly Wall Street, terribly conservative. They might resent that. He hurried into the other bedroom, which had become his dressing room, and took a tweed jacket with a plaid design from the closet and slipped it on. Time rolling by, rolling by. Much more casual, relaxed, a man in his own home, completely relaxed. But the soft tweed jacket didn't go with the hard-finished pants. Besides, a sport jacket. A sport. A young rip who takes wild rides in a sports roadster. He took off the tweed jacket and threw it on the day bed and hurried back to the master bedroom. His jacket and tie were strewn across a stuffed chair. He put on the tie and pulled it up into a tight knot. Time rolling by, rolling by. He put on the jacket and buttoned it. He lifted his chin and squared his shoulders. Wall Street. He went into the bathroom and brushed his hair back. He lifted his chin again. Be strong, a master of the universe. He rushed back down the hallway, then slowed down as he neared the stairs. He descended with a slow tread and tried to remember to keep himself erect. They were standing in the middle of the marble floor, two men and Benita. How strange it all seemed. The two men stood slightly spread-legged, and Benita stood 7 or 8 feet away as if they were her little flock. His heart was beating at a good clip. The larger of the two looked like a great slab of meat with clothes on. His suit jacket sat out from his wrestler's gut like cardboard. He had a fat, swarthy face, a Mediterranean face, to Sherman's way of thinking. He had a mustache that didn't go with his hair. The mustache curled down each side of his lips, a style that to a Pierce and Pierce bond salesman immediately said lower class. This one stared at Sherman as he came down the stairs, but the other one, the smaller one, didn't. He was wearing a sport jacket and the sort of brown pants a wife might choose to go with it. He was taking in the entry gallery, like a tourist. The marble, the yew-wood glove chest, the apricot silk on the walls, the Thomas Hope chairs, Judy's tens of thousands of hemorrhaging dollars' worth of perfect little details. The man's nose was big, and his chin and jaw were weak. He held his head cocked at an angle. He looked as if some terrific force had hit him on one side of his head. Then he turned his cockeyed stare toward Sherman. Sherman was aware of his heartbeat and the sound his shoes made as he walked across the marble. He kept his chin up and made himself smile amiably. "Gentlemen, how can I help you?" He looked at the big one when he said it, but it was the little one, the cockeyed one, who answered.
"Mr. McCoy? I'm Detective Martin, and this is Detective Goldberg."
Should he shake hands? Might as well. He held out his hand, and the small one shook it, and then the large one. It seemed to embarrass them. They didn't shake hands very forcefully.
"We're investigating an automobile accident involving a personal injury. Maybe you've read about it or seen something about it on television?"
He reached inside his jacket and pulled out a piece of paper, folded once down the middle. He handed it to Sherman. On it was a newspaper clipping, the original story from the City Light, the picture of the tall, skinny boy. Parts of the story were underlined in a yellow marker, Bruckner Boulevard, Mercedes-Benz, R. Would his fingers tremble? If he held the paper long enough to read the entire story, they would. He looked up at the two detectives.
"We saw something about this on television last night, my wife and I."
Should he say he was surprised, or what a coincidence? It dawned on him, in just these words, "I don't know how to lie."
"We thought, good Lord, we have a Mercedes, and the license number starts with R."
He glanced back down at the clipping and quickly returned it to the small one, Martin.
"You and a lot of people," said Martin with a reassuring smile. "We're trying to check them all out."
"How many are there?"
"A lot. We got a lot of officers working on this. My partner and me got a list here with about 20 on it ourselves.
Bonita was still standing there, looking on, taking it all in.
Well, come on in here, Sherman said to the one called Martin.
He motioned toward the library.
Bonita, do me a favor. If Mrs. McCoy and Campbell come back, tell them I'll be busy with these gentlemen in the library.
Bonita nodded and retreated toward the kitchen.
In the library, Sherman went around behind the desk and gestured toward the wing chair and the Sheraton armchair. The little one, Martin, looked all around. Sherman became acutely aware of how much obviously expensive stuff was crammed into this one small room, the fabulous clutter, the knick-knacks. And when the little detective's eyes reached the carved frieze, they remained pinned there. He turned toward Sherman with an open, boyish look on his face, as if to say, "Not bad." Then he sat down in the armchair, and the big one, Goldberg, sat down in the wing chair. Sherman sat down behind the desk.
"Well, let's see," said Martin. "Can you tell us if your car was in use the night this happened?
When exactly was it?"
"Well, now I'm committed to lying."
"Tuesday, a week ago," said Martin.
"I don't know," said Sherman. "I'd have to try to figure.
How many people use your car?"
"Me, mostly. Sometimes my wife."
"You have any children?"
"I have a daughter, but she's only 6.
"Anybody else have access to the car?"
"No, I guess not, except for the people at the garage."
"The garage?" asked Martin. "A parking garage?"
"Yes."
Why had he mentioned the garage?
"You leave the car there with the keys, and they park it?"
"Yes."
"Where is it, the garage?"
"It's near here."
Sherman's mind began spinning at a furious rate. They suspect the attendants. No, that's crazy. Dan. He could see the chubby little red-headed troll. He'll be happy to tell them I took the car out that night. Perhaps he wouldn't remember, or wouldn't know what night it was. Oh, he'll know, the way I froze him out.
"Could we go there and take a look at it?"
Sherman's mouth had gone dry. He could feel his lips contracting.
"The car?"
"Yes."
"When?"
"Soon's we leave here's good a time as any for us."
"You mean now?" "Well, I don't know."
Sherman felt as if the muscles of his lips were being constricted by a purse string.
"There's certain things that's consistent with an incident like this. If a car don't have those things, then we keep on going down the list. At this point, we're looking for a car. We don't have a description of a driver, so that okay with you?"
"Well, I don't know."
"No, let them look at it. There's nothing for them to find." Or is there? Something I don't know about, never heard of. But if I say no, they'll be suspicious. Say yes. But suppose the little red-headed attendant is on.
"It's the routine. We look at all the cars."
"I know, but if this is a routine, then I guess I ought to follow the routine that's appropriate to me, to someone with a car in this situation."
His mouth kept tightening. He saw the two men exchange glances. The small one, Martin, had a look of great disappointment on his face.
"You want to cooperate, don't you?"
"Yes, of course."
"Well, this is no big deal. This is part of the routine. We check the cars."
"I know, but if there's a routine, then that's what I should do, too, follow a routine. Or that would be the logical thing, it seems to me."
Sherman was acutely aware of sputtering nonsense, but he hung on to this word routine for dear life, if only he could control the muscles around his mouth.
"I'm sorry, I don't get it," said Martin. "What routine?"
"Well, you mentioned a routine, your routine, for investigating a case like this. I don't know how these things work, but there must be a routine for the owner of a car in this situation. I mean, I happen to own a car of a make and a license number with a license number, and I know there must be a routine. That's what I'm trying to say. I think that's what I need to consider. The routine."
Martin stood up and started looking at the carved frieze again. His eyes followed it halfway around the room. Then he looked at Sherman with his head at the cockeyed angle. There was a small smile on his lips, impudent,
chilling.
All right. The routine is. It ain't nothing complicated. If you want to cooperate with us, and you don't mind cooperating with us, then you cooperate with us, and we look at the car, and we go on our way. Nothing complicated. Okay? If you don't want to cooperate, if you have your reasons for not cooperating, then you don't cooperate. And then we have to go through channels. And the same thing happens anyway, and so it's up to you.
Well, it's just that he didn't know how he was going to end the sentence.
When's the last time you drove your car, Mr. McCoy?
It was the other one, the big one, Goldberg, who was still sitting in the wing chair. For an instant, Sherman was grateful for the change of subject. Let me see. Over the weekend, I guess, unless... Let me see. Have I driven it since then?
How many times you driven it over the past 2 weeks?
I don't know exactly. Let me see. He was looking at the great slab of meat in the wing chair, desperately trying to figure out how to lie to these questions, and out of the corner of his eye he could see the smaller one walking toward him around the side of the desk.
How often you usually drive it? Asked Goldberg.
It varies. How many times a week?
As I say, it varies. It varies. You drive it to work?
Sherman stared at the great slab of meat with the mustache, something grossly insolent about this interrogation. Time to cut it off, assert himself. But what tone to take? These two were connected by an invisible line to a dangerous power that he did not comprehend. What? The small one, Martin, had now come all the way around to his side of the desk. From way down here in his chair, Sherman looked up at Martin, and Martin looked down upon him with his cockeyed expression. At first he looked very sad. Then he smiled a brave smile.
"Look, Mr. McCoy," he said, smiling through his sadness, "I'm sure you want to cooperate, and I don't want to see you get hung up on the routine. It's just that we gotta go over everything in this case very carefully, because the victim, this Mr. Lamb, is in very bad shape. The best information we got is he's gonna die. So we're asking everybody to cooperate, but there's nothing says you have to. If you want to, you can say nothing at all. You have that right. You understand?"
When he said, "You understand," he cocked his head at an extreme angle and smiled an incredulous smile that indicated Sherman would have to be a terrible ingrate, troublemaker, and callous citizen indeed if he did not cooperate. Then he put both hands on top of Sherman's desk and leaned forward until his arms supported the weight of his upper body. This brought his face closer to Sherman's, although he was still looking down at him.
"I mean, you know," he said, "you have the right to an attorney."
The way he said attorney, it was as if he was trying to think of every crazy and ridiculous choice a man, a smaller and far more devious man than Sherman McCoy, might have.
"You understand, don't you?"
Sherman found himself nodding yes in spite of himself. A cold tremor began to spread through his body.
"I mean, for that matter, if you lacked the funds for an attorney..."
He said this with such a comradely smile and such great good humor, it was as if he and Sherman had been pals for years and had their little jokes.
"And you wanted an attorney, the state would provide you with one free of charge, if there was any reason you wanted one."
Sherman nodded again. He stared at the man's lopsided face. He felt powerless to act or resist. The man's message seemed to be, "I don't need to tell you these things. You're a substantial citizen, and you're above them. But if you aren't, then you must be the kind of germ we have to exterminate."
"All I'm saying is, we need your cooperation."
Then he swung about and sat on the edge of the desk and looked straight down into Sherman's face. "He's sitting on the edge of my desk." He smiled the warmest smile imaginable and asked softly,
"Well, what about it, Mr. McCoy? My partner was asking if you drive your car to work."
He kept smiling. The effrontery, the threat, sitting on my desk, the barbarous insolence. Well, do you? Smiling his lopsided smile. You drive it to work? Fear and outrage welled up together, but fear rose higher.
No, I don't.
Then when do you use it?
On the weekends, or whenever it's convenient, during the day, or maybe sometimes at night. I mean, not much during the day except when my wife uses it, which is to say, I mean, it's hard to say.
Could your wife have been using it Tuesday night a week ago?
No, I mean, I don't think so.
So, it might be you use it any time, but you don't remember.
It's not that, it's just that I use the car, I don't make a note of it, I don't keep a record. I don't think that much about it, I guess.
How often do you use it at night?
Desperately, Sherman tried to calculate the correct answer. If he said often, did that make it more likely he was out driving that night? But if he said seldom, then wouldn't he be more certain about whether he was driving or not that particular night?
I don't know, he said. Not a lot, but I guess reasonably often, comparatively.
Not a lot, but reasonably often, comparatively, said the little detective in a monotone.
By the time he reached comparatively, he was looking at his partner. He turned back and looked down at Sherman once more from his perch on the edge of the desk.
Well, let's get back to the car. Why don't we go take a look at it? What do you say?
Now?
Sure.
This isn't a good time. You got an appointment or something?
I'm waiting for my wife.
You going out?
The first person singular degenerated into a sigh.
You going out in the car? Asked Goldberg. We could take a look at it. Don't take a second.
For an instant, Sherman thought of bringing the car from the garage and letting them look at it in front of the building. But suppose they didn't sit still for that. Suppose they came along and talked to Dan.
I hear you say your wife's coming home soon, asked the smaller one. Maybe we ought to wait and talk to her, too. Maybe she'll remember if anybody was using the car Tuesday night a week ago.
Well, she... This isn't a good time, gentlemen.
When is a good time? Asked the smaller one.
I don't know. If you can just give me a little time to think about it.
Think about what? When's a good time? Or if you're going to cooperate?
It's not a question of that. I'm worried about the procedure.
The procedure?
Just how this should be handled, correctly.
Is the procedure the same as the routine?
The detective peered down at him with an insulting little smile.
Procedure? Routine? I'm not familiar with the terminology. I suppose it does come out the same.
I'm not familiar with it either, Mr. McCoy, because there ain't no such terminology, ain't no such procedure, ain't no such routine. You either cooperate in an investigation or you don't.
I thought you wanted to cooperate.
I do, but you've narrowed the choices. What choices?
Well, look, I guess what I should do is I should
talk this over with an attorney.
As soon as the words came out of his mouth, he felt he had made a terrible admission.
As I told you, said the little detective, that's your right. But why would you want to talk to an attorney? Why would you want to go to that trouble and expense?
I just want to make sure I proceed. Immediately, he was afraid he would be in trouble for uttering the verb form of procedure.
Correctly. The fat one, sitting in the wing chair, spoke up.
Let me ask you something, Mr. McCoy. Is there anything you'd like to get off your chest?
Sherman grew cold.
Get off my chest?
Because if there is, a fatherly smile, insolence, now is the time to do it, before things go any further and get complicated.
What would I have to get off my chest?
He meant to sound firm, but it came out bewildered.
That's what I'm asking you.
Sherman stood up and shook his head. I don't think there's any use continuing this right now. I'm going to have to talk. The little one, still sitting on the desk, finished the sentence for him.
To a lawyer?
Yes.
The small one shook his head the way you do when somebody you're advising seems determined to stick to a foolish course.
That's your privilege. But if you got anything substantial here to talk to a lawyer about, you're going to be better off coming out with it right now, and you're going to feel better. Whatever it is, it probably ain't as bad as you think. Everybody makes mistakes.
I didn't say there was anything substantial. There isn't. He felt trapped.
I'm trying to play their game when I should be rejecting the game itself.
You sure? Asked the fat one with what he obviously thought was a paternal smile on his face. In fact, it was horrible, obscene, the impudence.
Sherman edged past the smaller one, who remained seated on the desk, and followed him with his menacing little eyes. Near the door, Sherman turned around and looked at them both.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but I don't see any point in going into this. I don't think I should discuss it any further."
Finally, the smaller one stood up. "Finally removes himself from his insolent perch on my desk." He shrugged and looked at the fat one, who also stood up.
"Okay, Mr. McCoy," said the smaller one. "We'll see you with your lawyer."
The way he said it, it seemed to mean, "We'll see you in court." Sherman opened the door of the library and motioned for them to head out into the entry gallery. It seemed terribly important for him to usher them out and leave the room last, to prove that this was, after all, his household, and that he was master of it. When they reached the door to the elevator vestibule, the smaller one said to the fat one,
"Davy, you got a card? Give Mr. McCoy a card."
The fat one took a card from the side pocket of his jacket and handed it to Sherman. The card was wrinkled.
"You change your mind," said the smaller one. "You give us a call."
"Yeah, think it over," said the fat one with his hideous smile. "Whatever's on your mind, the sooner you tell us, the better it's going to be for you. That's the way it is. Right now you're still in a position to cooperate. You wait. The machinery starts."
He turned his palms up, as if to say, "And then you're in a hell of a mess." Sherman opened the door. The smaller one said,
"Think it over."
As they walked out, the fat one gave him a horrible wink. Sherman closed the door. They were gone. Far from being relieved, he was swept by an overpowering dismay. His entire central nervous system told him he had just suffered a catastrophic defeat, and yet he didn't know what had happened. He couldn't analyze his wounds. He had been outrageously violated, but how had it happened? How had these two insolent, low-rent animals invaded his life? When he turned around, Bonita had emerged from the kitchen and was standing on the edge of the marble floor. He had to say something to her. She knew they were the police.
"They're investigating an automobile accident, Bonita."
Too flustered.
"Oh, an accident,"
her wide eyes said. "Tell me more."
"Yes, I don't know. One of the cars involved had a license plate close to one of ours, or something."
He sighed and made a helpless gesture.
"I couldn't figure it all out."
"You don't worry, Mr. McCoy. They know it's not you."
The way she said it, he could tell he looked very worried indeed. Sherman went into the library and closed the door and waited 3 or 4 minutes. He knew it was irrational, but he had the feeling that if he didn't wait until the two policemen were out of the building, they would somehow reappear, pop back in just like that, smirking and winking in the horrible way they had. Then he called Freddie Button's home and left word that he should call whenever he got in. Maria had to talk to her. Did he dare call her? Didn't even know where she would be. The hideaway? The apartment on Fifth? Telephone tap. Could they somehow tap his telephone immediately? Had they left a listening device in the room? Calm down. That's crazy. But suppose Judy has already come back and I didn't hear her? He got up from the chair and walked out into his grand entry gallery. No one around. He heard a little clink-clink. Marshall's license tags.
The doleful dachshund came waddling out of the living room. The beast's toenails clattered on the marble. The little piece of salami that walks, the cause of half my problems. And what do you care about the police? Food and a walk, food and a walk. Then Bonita poked her head in the doorway. Don't want to miss anything, huh? Want to gobble up all the cop stuff, right? Sherman stared at her accusingly.
Oh, I think Mrs. McCoy come home, she said.
Don't worry, he said. When Mrs. McCoy and Campbell come in, you'll hear them. And until then, keep your nose out of my affairs. Picking up the tone of his voice clearly enough, Bonita retreated into the kitchen. Sherman headed back toward the library. I'll risk a call. Just then, the door from the elevator vestibule opened. Judy and Campbell. Now what? How could he call Maria? Would he have to tell Judy about the police first? If he didn't, Bonita would. Judy looked at him quizzically. What the hell was she wearing? White flannel pants, a white cashmere sweater, and some sort of black punk jacket with shoulder pads out to here, sleeves pushed up almost to her elbow, a collar with a ridiculously wide notch way down here. All the while, Campbell looked supremely ladylike in her burgundy Tolliver jumper and blazer and white blouse with a buttercup collar. Why was it that these days all the little girls were dressed like ladies and their mothers were dressed like teenage brats? Sherman, said Judy, looking concerned, is something wrong? Should he tell her about the police immediately? No. Get out and call Maria. No, he said. I was just...
Daddy, said Campbell, walking toward him. See these cards?
See these cards? She held up three miniature playing cards toward him, the Ace of Hearts, the Ace of Spades, and the Ace of Diamonds.
What are they?
She said. What are they? I don't know, sweetheart. Playing cards?
But what are they?
Just a minute, sweetie. Judy, I've got to go out for a minute.
Daddy, what are they?
The magician gave them to her, said Judy. Tell her what they are.
A little nod of the head that said, humor her. She wants to show you a trick. When I come back, he said to Campbell, I have to go out for just a second.
Daddy!
She hopped up and down, trying to put the cards right in his face. 1 second, sweetheart. You're going out? Said Judy. Where are you going? I have to go over to...
Daddy, tell me what they are!
Freddy Buttons.
Daddy!
Shh, said Judy. Hush up.
Daddy, look!
The three cards were dancing in the air in front of his face. Freddy Buttons, do you know what time it is? We have to get ready to go out.
Tell me what they are, Daddy!
Christ, he'd totally forgotten. They were supposed to go to dinner at these dreadful people's, the Bavardages. Judy's bunch, the social X-rays. Tonight? Impossible. I don't know, Judy. I don't know how long I'll have to be at Freddy's. I'm sorry, I...
What do you mean? You don't know?
Daddy!
Close to tears in her frustration.
For God's sake, Sherman, look at the cards.
Don't say God, Mommy.
You're absolutely right, Campbell. I shouldn't have said that.
He leaned over and peered at the cards. Well... The Ace of Hearts, the Ace of Spades, and the Ace of Diamonds.
You're sure?
Yes. Big smile, triumphant.
I just wave them like this?
She began fanning the cards about at a furious rate until they were a blur in the air.
Sherman, you don't have time to go to Freddy Buttons.
A stern and that's that look. Judy, I have to. Rolling his eyes toward the library as if to say, I'll explain it to you in there.
Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo, said Campbell. Now look, Daddy.
Judy, in a voice under tight rein, we're going to that dinner. He leaned over again. The Ace of Diamonds, the Ace of Hearts, the Ace of Clubs. What? Campbell, how did the Ace of Clubs get there? Delighted.
It just did.
Why... It's magic.
Sherman,
how did you do that? I can't believe it.
Sherman, did you hear me?
Campbell, with great modesty,
The magician showed me.
Ah, the magician. What magician?
At Mackenzie's birthday party.
That's amazing.
Sherman, look at me.
He looked at her.
Daddy, you want to see how I did it?
Sherman. More, and that's that.
Look, Daddy, I'll show you.
Judy, with frantic sweetness.
Campbell, you know who just loves magic tricks?
Who?
Bonita, she's crazy about them. Why don't you go show her before she's busy fixing your dinner? Then you can come back and show Daddy how you did it.
Oh, all right.
She trudged off to the kitchen disconsolately. Sherman felt guilty. Come on in the library, he said to Judy in a portentous voice. They went into the library, and he shut the door and told Judy to sit down. This will be too much for you to take standing up. She sat down in the wing chair, and he sat in the armchair. Judy, you remember that thing on television last night about the hit-and-run accident in the Bronx, and they're looking for a Mercedes with a license plate that begins with R?
Yes.
Well, two policemen came by here just before you and Campbell came home, two detectives, and they asked me a lot of questions.
Oh?
He described the interrogation, wanting it to sound menacing. I must go see Freddie Button, but avoiding his own feelings of inadequacy and fear and guilt. So I called Freddie, but he wasn't in, although they're expecting him, so I'm going over to his apartment and leave him this note. He pressed the breast of his jacket, as if there were a letter in the inside pocket. And if he's back, when I get there, I'll talk to him. So I'd better go. Judy just looked at him for a moment.
Sherman, that makes no sense whatsoever.
She spoke almost warmly, with a little smile, the way you talk to someone who needs to be coaxed back from the edge of the roof.
They're not going to put you in jail because you have half a license number.
I saw something in the Times about it this morning. Apparently there are 2,500 Mercedeses with license plates that begin with R. I was joking with Kate DiDucci at lunch. We had lunch at La Baue d'Argent. What on earth are you worried about? You certainly weren't out driving that night in the Bronx, whenever it was. Now, tell her. Get rid of this horrible weight once and for all. Come clean. With something approaching elation, he scaled the last few feet of the great wall of deceit he had erected between himself and his family and, well, I know I wasn't, but they acted as if they didn't believe me, and immediately fell back.
I'm sure you're imagining things, Sherman. That's probably just the way they are.
For goodness sake, if you want to talk to Freddie, you'll have plenty of time to talk to him in the morning. No, really, I've got to go over there. And have a long talk, if necessary. Well, yes, if necessary. She smiled in a way he didn't like. Then she shook her head. She was still smiling.
Sherman, we accepted this invitation 5 weeks ago. We're due there in an hour and a half, and I'm going, and you're going. If you want to leave the Bavardage's number for Freddie to call you, that's fine. I'm sure Inez and Leon won't mind, but we're going.
She continued to smile warmly at the jumper on the roof. And that's that. The calmness, the smile, the would-be warmth. Her face got the point across more firmly than any explanation she could have ever come up with. Words might have given him openings to wriggle through. This look offered no openings at all. Dinner at Inez and Leon Bavardage's was as important to Judy as the Giscard had been to him. The Bavardages were this year's host and hostess of the century, the most busily and noisily arrived of the arrivistes. Leon Bavardage was a New Orleans chicory salesman who had gone on to make a fortune in real estate. His wife, Inez, perhaps really was a member of an old Louisiana family, the Belairs. To Sherman, the Knickerbocker, they were ridiculous. Judy smiled, and she had never been more serious in her life.
But he had to talk to Maria.
He jumped up. All right, we're going, but I've got to run over to Freddy's. I won't be long.
Sherman, I promise you I'll be right back.
He all but ran across the dark green marble of the entry gallery. He halfway expected her to run after him and yank him back inside from the elevator vestibule.
Downstairs, Eddie, the doorman, said, "Evening, Mr. McCoy," and stared at him with a look that seemed to say, "And why did the cops come to see you?" "Hello, Eddie," he said, without pausing to look at him. He began walking up Park Avenue. Once he reached the corner, he rushed the fateful telephone booth. Carefully, carefully, he dialed Maria's number, first at the hideaway, no answer. Then he called the apartment on Fifth. A Spanish voice said Mrs. Ruskin couldn't come to the telephone. Damn! Should he say it's urgent? Should he leave his name? But the old man, her husband, Arthur, might very well be there. He said he would call back. Had to kill some time to make it plausible that he went to Freddie Button's building and dropped off a note and came back. He walked over to Madison Avenue, the Whitney Museum, the Carlyle Hotel. Three men came out of the door that led to the Café Carlyle. They were about his age. They were talking and laughing, with their heads thrown back, blissfully boiled. All three carried attaché cases, and two of them wore dark suits, white shirts, and pale yellow ties with small print patterns. These pale yellow ties had become the insignia of the worker bees of the business world. What the hell did they have to laugh and crow about, other than the alcoholic buzz in their brains, the poor deluded? He was experiencing the resentment of those who discover that, despite their own grave condition, the world goes on about its business, heartless, without even so much as a long face. When he returned to the apartment, Judy was upstairs in their bedroom suite. "Well, see, didn't take so long," he said. He sounded as if he expected a star for keeping his word. Several possible comments had time to run through her head. What she in fact said finally was, "We have less than an hour, Sherman. Now do me a favor. Please wear the navy suit you got last year, the deep navy, midnight blue, I think it is, and a solid tie, not one of those prints. That navy crepe de chine, or a shepherd's check is all right. You always look nice in those." "A shepherd's check is all right." He was overcome by despair and guilt. They were out there, circling, and he hadn't had the courage to tell her. She thought she could still afford the incalculable luxury of worrying about the correct necktie. Chapter 15. The Mask of the Red Death. Sherman and Judy arrived at the Bavardages building on Fifth Avenue in a black Buick sedan with a white-haired driver hired for the evening from Mayfair Town Car, Inc. They lived only six blocks from the Bavardages, but walking was out of the question. For a start, there was Judy's dress. It was bare-shouldered but had short puffed sleeves the size of Chinese lampshades covering the upper arms. It had a fitted waist but was puffed up in the skirt to a shape that reminded Sherman of an aerial balloon. The invitation to dinner at the Bavardages prescribed informal dress. But this season, as Tout le Monde knew, women dressed far more extravagantly for informal dinners in fashionable apartments than for formal dances in grand ballrooms. In any event, it was impossible for Judy to walk down the street in this dress. A 5-mile-an-hour headwind would have stopped her cold. But there was a yet more compelling reason for the hired car and driver. It would be perfectly okay for the two of them to arrive for dinner at a good building, the going term, on Fifth Avenue by taxi, and it would cost less than $3. But what would they do after the party? How could they walk out of the Bavardages building and have all the world, Tout le Monde, see them standing out in the street, the McCoys, that game couple, their hands up in the air, bravely, desperately, pathetically, trying to hail a taxi? The doormen would be no help, because they would be tied up ushering Tout le Monde to their limousines. So he had hired this car and this driver, this white-haired driver, who would drive them 6 blocks, wait 3.5 or 4 hours, then drive them 6 blocks and depart. Including a 15% tip and the sales tax, the cost would be $197.20, or $246.50, depending on whether they were charged for 4 or 5 hours in all. Hemorrhaging money. Did he even have a job left? Churning fear. Lopwitz. Surely Lopwitz wouldn't sack him because of 3 miserable days and $6 million, you ninny. Must start cutting back tomorrow. Tonight, of course, it was imperative to have a car and driver. To make matters worse, the driver couldn't pull up to the sidewalk near the entrance because so many limousines were in the way. He had to double park. Sherman and Judy had to thread their way between the limousines. Envy, envy. From the license plates, Sherman could tell that these limousines were not hired. They were owned by those whose sleek hides were hauled here in them. A chauffeur, a good one, willing to work long hours and late hours, cost $36,000 a year, minimum. Garage space, maintenance, insurance would cost another $14,000 at least, a total of $50,000, none of it deductible. I make $1 million a year, and yet I can't afford that. He reached the sidewalk. What? Just to the left, in the gloaming, a figure, a photographer, right over there. Sheer terror, my picture in the paper. The other boy, the big one, the brute, sees him and goes to the police. The police! The 2 detectives! The fat one, the one with the lopsided face. McCoy goes to parties at the Bavardages, does he? Now they truly smell blood. Horrified, he stares at the photographer and discovers that it's only a young man walking a dog. He has stopped near the canopy that leads up to the entrance, not even looking at Sherman, staring at a couple who are nearing the door, an old man in a dark suit and a young woman, a blonde, in a short dress. Calm down, for God's sake. Don't be crazy. Don't be paranoid. But a smirking, insulting voice says, "You got something you want to get off your chest?" Now Sherman and Judy were under the canopy, only 3 or 4 steps behind the old man and the blonde, heading for the entrance. A doorman in a starched white dickie pushed it open. He wore white cotton gloves. The blonde entered first. The old man, who was not much taller than she was, looked sleepy and somber. His thinning gray hair was combed straight back. He had a big nose and heavy eyelids, like a movie Indian. Wait a minute. I know him. No, he had seen him somewhere. But where? Bango. In a picture, of course, it was Baron Huxwald, the German financier. This was all Sherman needed on this night of all nights. After the catastrophes of the past 3 days, in this perilous low point of his career on Wall Street, to run into this man, whose success was so complete, so permanent, whose wealth was so vast and unassailable, to have set eyes upon this immovably secure and ancient German. Perhaps the Baron merely lived in this building. Please, God, don't let him be going to the same dinner party. In that very moment, he heard the Baron say to the doorman in a heavy European accent, "Bavardage." The doorman's white glove gestured toward the rear of the lobby. Sherman despaired. He despaired of this evening and of this life. Why hadn't he gone to Knoxville 6 months ago? A little Georgian house, a leaf-blowing machine, a badminton net in the backyard for Campbell. But no, he had to tag along behind this walnut-eyed German, heading for the home of some overbearingly vulgar people named Bavardage, a glorified traveling salesman and his wife. Sherman said to the doorman, "The Bavardages, please." He hit the accented syllable hard, so that no one would think he had paid the slightest attention to the fact that the noble one, Baron Huxwald, had said the same thing. The Baron, the blonde, Judy, and Sherman headed for the elevator. The elevator was paneled in old mahogany. It glowed. The grain was showy but rich and mellow. As he entered, Sherman overheard Baron Huxwald saying the name Bavardage to the operator, so Sherman repeated it, as before. The bavardages. Lest the Baron himself get the impression that he, Sherman, was cognizant of his existence. Now all four of them knew they were going to the same dinner party, and they had to make a decision. Did you do the decent, congenial, neighborly, and quite American thing? The sort of thing that would have been done without hesitation on an elevator in a similar building on Beacon Hill, or Rittenhouse Square, or in a building in New York, for that matter, if the party were being given by someone of good blood and good bone, such as Raleigh or Pollard. In the present company, Pollard suddenly seemed quite okay, quite a commendable old knickerbocker. Did you do the good-spirited thing, and smile and introduce yourselves to one another? Or did you do the vulgar, snobbish thing, and stand there and pretend you were unaware of your common destination, and stare stiffly at the back of the elevator operator's neck while this mahogany cab rose up its shaft? Sherman cut an exploratory glance at Hoxvald and the blonde. Her dress was a black sheath that ended several inches above her knees and hugged her luscious thighs, and the lubricious declivity of her lower abdomen, and rose up to a ruff at the top that resembled flower petals. Christ, she was sexy. Her creamy white shoulders and the tops of her breasts swelled up as if she was dying to shed the sheath and run naked through the begonias. Her blonde hair was swept back to reveal a pair of enormous ruby earrings. No more than 25 years old. A tasty morsel. A panting animal. The old bastard had taken what he wanted, hadn't he? Hoxvald wore a black serge suit, a white shirt with a spread collar, and a black silk necktie with a large, almost rakish knot. All of it fashioned just so. Sherman was glad Judy had pressured him into wearing the navy suit and navy tie. Nevertheless, the Baron's ensemble seemed terribly smart by comparison. Now he caught the old German flicking his eyes up and down Judy and himself. Their glances engaged for the briefest of instants. Then both stared once more at the piping on the back of the collar of the elevator operator. So they ascended, an elevator operator and four social mutes, toward some upper floor. The answer was, "You did the vulgar, snobbish thing." The elevator stopped, and the four mutes walked out into the bavardage's elevator vestibule. It was lit by clusters of tiny silk lampshades on either side of a mirror with a gilded frame. There was an open doorway. A rich and rosy glow. The sound of a hive of excited voices. They went through the doorway, into the apartment's entry gallery. Such voices, such delight, such laughter. Sherman faced catastrophe in his career, catastrophe in his marriage, and the police were circling. And yet the hive, the hive, the hive! The sonic waves of the hive made his very innards vibrate. Faces full of grinning, glistening, boiling teeth. How fabulous and fortunate we are, we few, to be in these upper rooms together, with our radiant and incarnadine glows. The entry gallery was smaller than Sherman's, but whereas his, decorated by his wife, the interior designer, was grand and solemn, this one was dazzling, effervescent. The walls were covered in a brilliant Chinese red silk, and the silk was framed by narrow gilded moldings, and the moldings were framed by a broad burnt umber upholsterer's webbing, and the webbing was framed by more gilded moldings, and the light of a row of brass sconces made the gilt gleam, and the glow of the gilt and the Chinese red silk made all the grinning faces and lustrous gowns yet more glorious. He surveyed the crowd, and immediately sensed a pattern. Presque vu, presque vu, almost seen. And yet he couldn't have put it into words. That would have been beyond him. All the men and women in this hall were arranged in clusters, conversational bouquets, so to speak. There were no solitary figures, no strays. All faces were white. Black faces might show up occasionally at fashionable charity dinners, but not in fashionable private homes. There were no men under 35, and precious few under 40.
The women came in two varieties. First, there were women in their late 30s and in their 40s and older, women of a certain age, all of them skin and bones, starved to near perfection. To compensate for the concupiscence missing from their juiceless ribs and atrophied backsides, they turned to the dress designers. This season, no puffs, flounces, pleats, ruffles, bibs, bows, battings, scallops, laces, darts, or shirrs on the bias were too extreme. They were the social X-rays, to use the phrase that had bubbled up into Sherman's own brain. Second, there were the so-called lemon tarts. These were women in their 20s or early 30s, mostly blondes, the lemon and the tarts, who were the second, third, and fourth wives or live-in girlfriends of men over 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, the sort of women men refer to, quite without thinking, as girls. This season, the tart was able to flaunt the natural advantages of youth by showing her legs from well above the knee and emphasizing her round bottom, something no X-ray had. What was entirely missing from Shea Beverdage was that manner of woman who is neither very young nor very old, who has laid in a lining of subcutaneous fat, who glows with plumpness and a rosy face that speaks without a word of home and hearth and hot food ready at 6 and stories read aloud at night and conversations while seated on the edge of the bed just before the Sandman comes. In short, no one ever invited Mother. Sherman's attention was drawn to a bouquet of ecstatic boiling faces in the immediate foreground. Two men and an impeccably emaciated woman were grinning upon a huge young man with pale blonde hair and a cowlick at the top of his forehead. Met him somewhere, but who is he? Bango. Another face from the press. The golden hillbilly. The toe-headed tenor. That was what they called him. His name was Bobby Shafflett. He was the new featured tenor of the Metropolitan Opera, a grossly fat creature who had somehow emerged from the upland hollows of the Appalachians. You could hardly read a magazine or a newspaper without seeing his picture. As Sherman watched, the young man's mouth opened wide. Ha 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 ha. He broke into a huge barnyard laugh, and the grinning faces around him became even more radiant, more transported than before. Sherman lifted his Yale chin, squared his shoulders, straightened his back, raised himself to his full height, and assumed the presence of an older, finer New York, the New York of his father, the Lion of Dunning Spunget. A butler materialized and asked Judy and Sherman what they wanted to drink. Judy asked for sparkling water. To say Perrier or any other brand name had become too trite. Sherman had intended to drink nothing. He had intended to be aloof from everything about these people, these Beverdages, starting with their liquor. But the hive had closed in, and the cowlicked toehead of the golden hillbilly boomed away. "A gin and tonic," said Sherman McCoy from the eminence of his chin. A blazing, bony little woman popped out from amid all the clusters in the entry gallery and came toward them. She was an X-ray with a teased blonde pageboy bob and many tiny, grinning teeth. Her emaciated body was inserted into a black and red dress with ferocious puffed shoulders, a very narrow waist, and a long skirt. Her face was wide and round, but without an ounce of flesh on it. Her neck was much more drawn than Judy's. Her clavicle stuck out so far Sherman had the feeling he could reach out and pick up the two big bones. He could see lamplight through her ribcage. "Dear Judy!" "Inez," said Judy. And the two of them kissed, or rather, swung their cheeks past one another, first on this side, then on that side, in a European fashion that Sherman, now the son of that staunch Knickerbocker, that old family patriarch, that low church episcopal scourge of the fleshpots, John Campbell McCoy, found pretentious and vulgar.
"Inez, I don't think you've met Sherman,"
she forced her voice into an exclamation in order to be heard above the hive.
"Sherman, this is Inez Bavardage."
"How'd you do?" said the lion scion.
"I certainly feel like I know you,"
said the woman, looking him squarely in the eye and flashing her tiny teeth and thrusting her hand toward him. Overwhelmed, he took it.
"You should hear Jean Lopwitz go on